Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
You're listening to Retronauts, a part of the HyperX Podcast Network. Find us and more great shows like us at podcast.hyperx.com.
Hi, this week in Retronauts, we can actually say big in Japan and mean it. Thank you for attending this panel. We're looking at classic 2023. We're taking you back in time many, many years to talk about the 1980s and games that helped influence the design and shape of Japanese games for many years to come. So we're talking about some foundational works here on this panel. And joining me, Retronauts co-host Jeremy Parrish, we have another Retronauts co-host.
Hello, I'm Nadia Oxford. I also am the co-host of the Acts of the Blood God RPG podcast. Nice to see you all.
And to my right,
I'm Brian Clark from 1 Million Power.
And even further to my right,
and I'm Kevin Bunch from Atari Archive, the YouTube series.
So, speaking of YouTube, this presentation was really kind of inspired by the YouTube videos that I've been producing, Game Boy Works, NES Works, etc., because it's become kind of a running joke that I keep going back to these certain games and talking about how important they were, foundational they were, to the point that I've had to start putting a lost time, you know, it's been 0 days since we had a work-related accident connected to Zevius or Heianki of Alien. And it kind of started out as a little bit of a running joke, just like any time something came up that was sort of a maze chase game, I would say, oh yeah, it's kind of a drawing from Heianki of Alien. But as I covered more and more of these games, I've come to realize that, yeah, like, there are some kind of foundational works that when you look back at Japanese game design of the 80s, and when you read interviews with developers from the 80s who were active in that period, they just had a massive influence. It's like, you know, everyone played these games or was aware of these games, and they helped to shape the games that they created in turn. And so you kind of look at these particular games we're going to talk about today, and from those ideas, basically, you know, like, this very different form of gaming than we had here in the U.S. or they had over in Europe kind of took shape. And these are kind of where a lot of those ideas came from. But to begin with, we're actually going to talk about an American game that was produced created in the late 70s at Atari called Breakout. And this game, you know, everyone's played Breakout, but it's really surprising how much influence it had on Japanese game design, including, you know, basically serving as the inspiration for the shoot 'em up genre, which might seem a little counterintuitive. But I don't know, Kevin, this seems to be kind of a pet topic of yours. Do you want to walk us through Breakout, what it's about, and how it you know, how it had an impact on Japanese game design?
Yeah, so Breakout, you know, produced by Atari in 1976, originally conceived by Atari for leading the original prototype by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, that was now the final design by Gary Waters. It was distributed in Japan by Masaya Nakamura of Namco. They were Atari's distributor at the time. And the game was such a hit that he was not able to get enough stock shipped over from Atari in the U.S. to meet demand. So a bunch of other companies started producing their own clones of Breakout. Eventually, he broke his contract with Atari and started producing his own copies just to make up the gap, but it was a huge hit over there and a huge success. It's sort of the first game to have one of the first games to have a wave format. So you finish off the first wall and then the second one will spawn. And it only goes two walls. It's, I clearly Atari did not think anyone was going to go any further than that. But that was sort of a major factor going forward to sort of the most obvious game inspired by it, and that's Space Invaders. Because Tomohiro Nishikado of Taito saw Breakout at an arcade, and he was just shocked that people were so into this game that looked, well, so old-fashioned, looked like a Paul and Pong-style game, but people were really into it, and he sort of got his wheels turning, and he thought, well, okay, what if we change the battle into something that was firing bullets? Well, at that point, the wall was just a wall, so it's got to move. So we broke that down into specific targets, and then that we have this target start firing back down, and eventually we became, you know, the space aliens. And then we sort of add some pressure, start having them move back and forth, and move down the screen. And that sort of built upon the way before I even further by having different rounds, you know, into infinity, more or less. But, you know, that's sort of the main step of Breakout's influence in Japan. You also got games like Arkanoid or the Bombay trilogy that Namco did. And I think it's worth noting, too, that...
Wasn't there one on the Game Boy, like Alleyway or something like that?
Alleyway was on the Game Boy. I think it's very interesting that because so many companies were getting out of the Breakout boom, like that's where SNK's first games were, their Breakout clones. And then when the Space Invaders boom busted, a bunch of the companies started producing their own games off of the Space Invaders hardware, and they have a bunch of more sitting around. So Breakout sort of stands out in that way too.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning that you know, Breakout is kind of an evolution of Pong, where you take Pong and turn it sideways and then replace player two with just a wall of bricks you have to hit. And, you know, everyone who was making video games in the mid-1970s made dedicated Pong consoles. That was the business for quite a while, for a couple of years. And you didn't really see as many Breakout dedicated machines, because by the point that Breakout became sort of big, the idea of cartridges and interchangeable games and systems became a bigger deal. So you would see some occasionally, but it sort of became its own, really kind of its own genre in Japan called block kuzushi. Is that right?
That's right.
And you still see a lot of these games being made, being developed. And, you know, Kevin mentioned Arkanoid, which, you know, that's always been a big hit for Taito, the creators of Space Invaders, to the point that the recent Egret 2 mini console or mini arcade machine that they just produced, you can buy an optional add-on that's really sort of built around Arkanoid. It's a spinner, and it's a great little spinner. Like, it has really good feel to it, and you can play like a pretty good version of Arkanoid, the arcade.
Three different versions.
Okay, three different versions. And, you know, they released a special Arkanoid controller for the NES and the Famicom. And then also there was a sequel that only came out in Japan for Famicom that had its like an upgraded controller. And then there was the DS paddle that you could plug into.
Just playing this, I played this on the Atari 2600, and just thinking about how I went through all that with the janky control, like a joystick, and realizing, hey, I actually did pretty good for myself. I'll consider it.
I mean, you can always play this kind of game with a joystick, but, you know, I think Taito kind of seized on it with Arkanoid, and like I said, there was even a DS version that you could plug in a little paddle dial into the slot 2 of the original DS and the DS Lite, and play a great version of not only Arkanoid, but also Space Invaders, which is, you know, Space Invaders Extreme, which is all part of the same family. It all kind of belongs together. Anyway, so I mentioned that Pong, turn it sideways, give you, you know, replace player two, you come up with Breakout. You turn, as Kevin said, you turn the wall into aliens that can shoot back, and you have Space Invaders. Now, if you take that another step, and you allow the wall not to just move, but to actually break formation and fly at you and dive bomb you, you get Galaxian, and then Galaga. And then from one step beyond that, you get the next game we're going to talk about, which is Zevius, or Zevius if you prefer. It's a whole religious thing. I'm not going to get into it. I just say Zevius. It's fine. But this is one of the biggest, most influential, most significant games ever produced by a Japanese game manufacturer. It was created by Namco, who we've already mentioned. And it's just been something that I've really, like, I've always appreciated the fact that, hey, Zevius was a good game, and it was very, you know, very popular. But over the past few years, I've really come to appreciate the fact that this game was huge. Like, when you read interviews with developers from the 80s, so many times they mentioned Zevius either as just a thing that got them addicted to video games and started them playing, or as a thing that they saw and said, we have to make a game that's better than this. And it was this huge inspiration just in terms of getting people to play games and to, you know, kind of push their design ideas further and inspire them to move beyond what already existed. Zevius, I don't know, like, I feel like it was not really that big a deal over here.
I mean, people, don't remember anybody ever mentioning it. In fact, finding out how much of a big deal it was, I was mostly through, like, your videos and realizing how different, and this is something we'll get into, I'm sure, how different the landscape was for, the nostalgic landscape for Japan versus America is so, so different. And I think that's fascinating, really.
Even now, when you read, like, Yuzo Koshiro, I think, has done some interviews recently with some of, like, the Kyukyoku Tiger collections and things like that, and it comes up in the most unexpected places. It's like anytime you ask someone from that era about what they used to play in the arcade, it's always Zevius, like almost 100% of the time.
Yeah,
so Zevius, if you've never played it, it's, you know, a shooter, kind of like Galaga, or, you know, it takes away the formation of enemies at the top of the screen and just has enemies sort of move in waves toward you. And they all have their formations. Most of them have a tendency when they'll take shots at you as they come in, or they'll just, you know, try to swoop across the screen and distract you. But when they actually cross your line of sight, they'll peel away. So there has to be this element of strategy. They're not really going after you to crash into you like in a lot of shooters. They're kind of being evasive. And it sort of lures you away from playing safe because you have to kind of line up your shots and move aggressively to take out the enemies and get points. But at the same time, there's things flying at you. There's bullets coming from not only aerial enemies, but also ground-based enemies. And that was one of the big innovations of Zevius, was to create two layers of action. Even though it's a top-down shooter, you have the aerial threats, which are very mobile and tend to be evasive. And then you have the ground-based threats, which move independently of you. But you have two different weapons, one that shoots air-to-air and one that shoots air-to-ground, and has a targeting reticle that is a fixed distance from your ship. So that introduces another layer of strategy, because if you want to take out ground emplacements, which is, you know, where you get a lot of point bonuses and also some of those things are shooting at you, you have to, you know, time your attacks, your little bomb, to, you know, correspond to where your target's going to be, and you have to think ahead. So it's a game that really operates in four dimensions by adding that three-dimensionality, because you have to really, more so than even in Space Invaders or something, you have to think about, like, where is the enemy going to be? And you really have to lead them and, you know, kind of think ahead to how they're going to act. And then you get to the final boss, basically, the Andor's Genesis mothership at the end of the stage, which looks like a big flying aerial fortress. But actually, you can only destroy it by dropping a bomb into it, which is a little counterintuitive.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the origin of, you know, the Danmaku bullet hell genre, because when you reach the Andor Genesis, all of a sudden enemies just start spawning and flying at you. These don't peel away from you. They come at you and they're shooting, you know, projectiles at you. So it you know, has this like actual boss attack phase that's very, very challenging, and it all lasts like 3 or 4 seconds. But, you know, in that short amount of time, you have to really think ahead and react and, you know, just be on your toes.
One interesting thing to mention about it, it was designed by a guy named Masanobu Endo, who was working for Namco at the time, but he was the closest thing he really had to, like, kind of like a rock star, like, well-known game designer. He did Zevius, he did Tower of Draga, which I think might be coming up later. I think those were his big hits, but he also did a Famicom, one of the first Famicom games for Gundam, Zeta Gundam Hot Scramble, which is weirdly like...
That was him?
That was him. It was weirdly, like, say whatever you want about it, but it was like an early, like, first-person shooting kind of game. It has problems apart from that. But yeah, he was quite well-known, and he went on to become like an early mover and shaker in like the mobile game world, and I think he is the director of like the Digital Games Research Association of Japan right now.
My first shoot 'em up original was, I think, 1942 for the NES. I probably should play Zippies.
I played a lot of Zippies on the 1700, because that's what I had.
But that was a good port.
Yeah, it was a really good port. One thing that is very interesting and sort of ties into, I guess, Endo's game design is that Zebius has hidden items that if you bomb nondescript parts of the screen, you'll get like a point bonus, and that's sort of instrumental to doing well in the game.
A lot of them made it so big in arcades too, like this kind of like secrets, discovering secrets and sharing it with other people sort of thing.
Yeah, and I don't think too many games did that before Zebius.
Yeah, and there are a few other things that make Zebius kind of memorable. You know, for one thing, you have a background to it. You're not just flying through the blackness of space. You've got this scenery beneath you, and it kind of it doesn't really tell a story, but it's evocative. Like you're going over what kind of look like mountainous paths, and then you go over bases, and then you cross over the Nazca lines from Peru, which is just kind of random, but it really sticks with you, and that's become a thing that you see in a lot of video games. Just like, you know, the Nazca lines, the eagle and everything.
Yeah, so very, very, very
just because, you know, people remember that. And here's an example of a terrible game that was inspired by Zebius. And a much better game, although it's can't really see what's happening there. Life Force. So many vertical shooters were inspired by Zebius. And it's just a game that it's a building block. And something I've really been kind of surprised by, or maybe struck by. I've been watching a lot of old vintage, you know, 1980s Japanese cartoons over the past couple of years. And anytime you have something that's kind of set in the real world or is meant to be like a civilian situation where people go to arcades, they use Zebius as sort of the thing you see on screen. So I'm thinking Megazone 23, Kimigure Orange Road, even Macross, Robotech, has a sort of Zebius fakery, you know, a fake Zebius in its arcade. Yeah. It's just shorthand, basically. Like, if you go to an arcade, you know, once the Invader boom was over, it was just the Zebius boom.
Over here, we got the Donkey Kong and Pac-Man and Atari sound effects. They got Zebius.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah, we have the stand-in. But do we all have the crazy button mashing that actually does nothing? Like, is that cross-cultural in a movie or something?
Yeah, I'm actually glad you mentioned the sound effects, too, because the soundscape of Zebius is another remarkable thing about it. You can't hear it here, but Zebius has this loop. It's a very kind of annoying loop after a while. It really gets in your head. But it was music in a you know, format that didn't really often have original music, and kind of became a thing in its own right. Like, people would remix the music or use it as a kind of like the underlying loop for their own original compositions.
It's what my dad would call "turn off that damn game music."
it just hit on so many levels and became a huge success. And you know, anytime you play a top-down shooter of pretty much any sort, you're seeing the children of Zebius.
Yeah. This sounds like a movie. I like that. A sci-fi movie.
They did make a Zebius movie that I'm pretty sure is lost media right now.
Has there been a Zebius movie? Or
like 2001-ish, I think.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
That's on my must-watch list, yeah.
If you can find it.
Triangle Ship versus the World.
So that's the shooter facet of things. Now we're going to move on to the maze chase and a game called Heianchio Alien, which did come to America. You can buy it on Game Boy, probably out on the floor for like $5. No one appreciates it. So it's still cheap. So go grab a copy. Buy them up while they're still, you know, before the world catches on.
They always catch on, so watch it.
But Heianchio Alien is interesting because it has a sort of unique backstory. I don't know if one of you guys want to jump in and take over here so this isn't just me ranting for an hour.
Yeah, I mean, from what I know of it, I'm certainly not Mr. Heiakyo Alien like Jeremy here. That's your official title now.
Heiakyo Alien Song.
Yeah. But it came basically out of from Tokyo University students, right? I think it was it a project or something to that effect that they then kind of ran with?
There's a game production company,
yes,
that they basically got pitched to when they picked it up. The original version was for the Apple II, and apparently it was so unoptimized that it took 10 minutes to load.
Yeah. Oh my gracious.
So that is not
how long are you willing to wait for your Heiakyo Alien? The answer is probably not 10 minutes.
But, you know, it is an early Maze Chase game. It was it's one of the big hits of the Maze Chase pre-Pac-Man and like Sega's head-on. And this one has, you know, different little alien enemies. They're running around the maze. They're trying to, you know, kill you, obviously. They move randomly, which is kind of annoying, but it's an early title that has multiple buttons for different actions. So there's when you fight these aliens is you dig holes, wait for them to fall in, and then bury them before they
can pull them out. I like that. That's grim.
Yeah, it's a very grim game. It's dark. But, I feel that popularized that sort of game design a bit in Japan, just not having a one-button game or a no-button game like right now in Space Invaders.
I just want to give a shout out to my favorite Maze Chase game. That's probably Lock and Chase for the Game Boy. It's severely underrated.
It's a very good.
It's so weird. It has one of the best soundtracks on the Game Boy. It's just it's a great Maze Chase game. It's very short, but if you ever want like a really good, clever, fun game, like it's much, much different than the NES game, but it's definitely one of my favorites when we're playing.
Yeah, Lock and Chase owes a lot to Heiakyo Alien, and the Game Boy version owes a lot to Sokoban, which probably should have gone in this panel, but we can't talk about Sokoban anymore.
Is there a lot?
No, I'm just tired of it. Heiakyo Alien, you know, it's set in Heian area of Japan, which is how many hundreds of years ago? Like,
oh god,
two or three?
Put me on the spot.
You're a policeman trying to protect the citizens of Kyoto from an alien invasion, and all you have is a shovel. So you dig holes, alien falls in the hole, you bury it. But this simple sandbox of design really caught on, and it inspired some of the first strategy guides to be written about video games.
Sure.
It wasn't like full book strategy guides, but there were magazines that talked about different strategies and tactics, and these have become kind of ingrained in game design. And this, you know, Heiakyo Alien was eventually overshadowed by the success of games that were inspired by it. You know, there was Space Panic from Universal, which kind of took Heiakyo Alien, the top-down view, and put it on the side, and that went on to create, you know, to inspire Lode Runner. But also, you know, games like Pac-Man owe a huge debt to Heiakyo Alien. There are lots and lots of games that are kind of built in the same style, like Boomer's Adventure and Asmic World for Game Boy, Sinbad Mystery, a game by Sega. It's just, you know, it's a very influential and mostly forgotten game, although I talk about it so much that anyone who's ever visited my YouTube channel has at least heard of it. So next, we're going to spend the rest of the panel, I think, really kind of talking about the evolution of role-playing games.
Yeah.
That's why not easy.
Oh, is that why? Oh,
that's it. So when you look at the really, really huge influential RPGs that shaped the direction of kind of that genre in Japan, it actually goes back to not a Japanese game, not a game from the U.S., but actually a Canadian game. Shout out to Nadia.
I was looking at these notes and I realized Wizardry, we're talking about Wizardry. I had no idea it started as a Canadian franchise, and then obviously it was bought out very quickly by like the second game or something like that. But yeah, Wizardry, it's a basically extremely popular, extremely influential maze crawling game. You select your party. It's kind of like a tabletop come to life, and you put you in a maze to die. It's I find it, like, some people find it very archaic, some people find it very difficult to play, but in any case, it was a huge, huge hit in Japan, especially over the import scene, and if I'm not mistaken, probably word of mouth really picked up from there, and that's partially owed to the gentleman who eventually founded Bulletproof Software. What was his name?
But he brought Rogers.
Hank Rogers. He brought it kind of to the Japanese, like, collective and said, hey, look at this cool-ass game, and Sure enough, a lot of developers were like...
Sort of. Hank Rogers created the game that we're looking at right now, Blackonics.
Yeah.
And that was definitely inspired by Wizardry. But Wizardry actually had life in Japan, despite not being formally localized, for quite a while. You know, game developers tended to be people who were really on the inside when it came to computer hardware. And, you know, you look at the U.S., you look at Japan, you look at Europe, we all had different 8-bit computers back in the late 70s, early 80s. And so things like the Apple II and the Commodore PET, those weren't really, you couldn't really get those in Japan, but there were always import shops for, you know, the tinkerers and the nerds who were willing to pay down, you know, the equivalent of $10,000 to get a really cool piece of kit that was from, you know, from overseas and could do stuff that the homebrew computers couldn't.
Shout out to your character names there, by the way. Sega Aiden.
Sega Aiden SG-1K. yes, this is the Sega SG-1000 port of the Black Onyx. But, you know, people who worked in game development would either see these games running on demo in game shops and be like, oh, I wish I could have, you know, the equivalent of $10,000 to afford that. Or else they would come over to things like Worldwide Developers Conference. And you know, Apple computers events and that sort of thing, and they would see these games and just say, "Oh, I've got to play this," and bring them back home. And that's where games like Dragon Quest came from. People like Yuji Horii, who directed Dragon Quest, just loved Wizardry, and it was
Yuji Horii, as I recall, wanted to bring the Wizardry kind of gameplay to the masses. But of course, it's, as I said earlier, it's a little bit complicated. So hey. What if we took this idea, made the computer do the hard work with all the numbers, and most importantly, give it kind of a manga style to really get younger players interested, and to extend on that, put it on the Famicom, which was a console for younger players, whereas adults tended to stick to the computers. So that was a major... He basically tapped an untapped market.
And Wizardry is a very strange series in the sense that it started in, you know, the U.S. and Canada, and it had several sequels here, all the way through Wizardry 7. But it kind of dropped off after a while.
I like how you put in the notes, it's still a thing of concern in Japan.
It is a thing of concern. Have you played some of those games? They're pretty concerning. No, there were some rights issues, and things were sold off, and so the rights to Wizardry are... They're a mess right now.
Yeah.
But there are Japanese developers, Japanese studios, who have the rights to create new Wizardry games. And I think the last Wizardry that was published in the U.S. was Wizardry... The Forsaken Empire for PlayStation 2, is that what it was called? It was a PS2 game published by Atlus. But overseas, there's like a new Wizardry game every year. I think there's one that just came out. It's like a mobile game.
Probably.
With NFTs or something. They just announced an NFT Wizardry that has nothing to do with the original creators. It's just like this company over there saying, yeah, let's just run with it.
It's a name at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like
exactly.
To attach a game to.
But despite that, you know, the series continued to thrive over there, at least, you know, in a niche, whereas it didn't here. And the first-person dungeon crawler continued to thrive in a way that it didn't here. You know, you saw games that built on it over there, not just the Black Onyx, but Phantasy Star is a great example.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a huge one. And you know, even though that was on kind of a less popular system over in Japan, it still had an impact.
It actually still holds up. The M2 release of Phantasy Star for the Switch is
very much
worth playing, especially since it has the maps. If you don't have the maps...
They did a lot to fix it up.
Yes.
Yeah, but mapping was a very important part of Wizardry, and the game didn't do it for you. You did it on graph paper, and eventually you got to the floors where there were teleporter mazes that would just zap you across the floor.
That's right, Gamer.
And you had no way to orientate yourself, so you just had to kind of guess, where am I? But this style of game lived on, you know, with things like Arcana for Super NES. A really big one was Megami Tensei, now Shin Megami Tensei. The first 10 years of that series, it was all first-person dungeon crawlers. If you go back and play the original Persona, that's a dungeon crawler, very much in the Wizardry style. And they still do those occasionally, you know, Strange Journey for DS
for 10 years
ago. And then Persona Q, which was a crossover between Shin Megami Tensei and Atlus's other dungeon crawler RPG series, Etrian Odyssey, which was extremely Wizardry, but it was, you know, modernized. And
genius, actually, the way you could write basically as a DS series, so you could, and 3DS, and you could draw your own maps, and that is, that's like such a perfect combination of a middle ground, you know, like you don't have to sit there with your graph paper and your reused notebooks, and you don't have to guess. It's just like, hey, I can draw these maps while I'm playing. And you know what? It's very satisfying. I'm not a mapper, and I just love Etrian Odyssey.
Yeah, and these games have become, I think because of Etrian Odyssey, have started to have a resurgence here. At least, you know, they're never going to be up in, you know, the Madden NFL or Call of Duty tier of sales, but at least developers or publishers are willing to localize them and take a chance on them. So you get stuff like Labyrinth of Refrain or Demon's Gaze, which aren't necessarily great examples of the dungeon crawler genre, but it's still like this strain of game design, strand of game design that has survived intact for, you know, 45 years at this point, which is very impressive.
There's just something appealing about getting lost and trying to get out without screaming your guts out in panic.
And I don't know, Wizardry has enough teeth now. Might make it. Might hit it big. It could be what it needed.
And that's just what it's going to need. To the other side of the RPG coin, you have Origins Ultima 3. There had been a couple of Ultima games, obviously, before Ultima 3, but they were kind of weird and messy, and like some of them had shoot 'em up segments and stuff. They weren't very like what you think of as an RPG, but Ultima 3 was very much an RPG in the sort of, I mean, it's really the foundation of the JRPG that we think of as the JRPG.
Yeah, and thinking about it, see, I never played a whole lot of Ultima, but I know it was on the NES, and it was definitely a little bit more of a complex game. I don't know if any of you remember Video Power. I'd always remember that being one of the games they gave away. Ultima.
Yeah, so Ultima really sort of codified what would become the sort of baseline Japanese RPG, in that it had sort of a zoomed out overworld, and then you'd go into towns and it was a much closer view. When you had battles, instead of being, you know, the standard like two sides line up and take turns hitting each other, you had some limited movement around the battlefield to line up against enemies. You were really in kind of an open world and just had to sort of figure things out. There were all kinds of really arcane secrets hidden within the world. Things like the moon gates and the moon phases. There were two moons in the world, and the phase of the moon affected different mystical elements around the world.
Very much became part of Shin Megami Tensei.
Yep.
Moon phases are everything.
Yeah. And there were shrines where you could go and make donations for, you didn't know why exactly until you started making donations, and then, you know, that would kind of pick up. So anyway, that's really very influential. Like the combat system in Ultima, we don't have an example up here, but if you've played games like Lunar or, you know, even American games like the SSI Gold Box D&D games or Wasteland, the early Fallouts, those are all very much in kind of the Ultima mold.
Yeah, shout out to, very quickly, Ultima 4, which I think really expanded the idea in massive ways of player choice, which, of course, is a huge, huge part of RPGs these days, games in general.
Yeah, player choice and player morality really became... Yeah. There was some of that in Ultima 3, you know, where some of your actions had impact. But in Ultima 4, like, it begins with a tarot reading to determine what your, you know, your strengths are based on your personal choices. And you had to become the avatar of goodness. And that was the entire point of the game. And if you performed bad actions like killing civilians, that would, you know, take away and make it much harder for you to become the avatar.
Make it be very not popular if you're talking about killing civilians.
I mean, when you look at Ultima, like, you can really see the games by Yasumi Matsuno, like the Ogre series, Final Fantasy Tactics. There's a whole lot of that built in. You know, the Ogre series morality plays a huge part into you know, there's like 60 endings or something in Ogre Battle and Tactics Ogre. And, you know, it's not always the obvious moral choices that you have to make to get the best outcomes.
And now Triangle Strategy on the Switch, the whole thing is about making choices. And those choices aren't always very obvious. You could say, I'm going to do the right thing. And everyone says, you dumbass, you did the, this is like not as good as you think it is. And that's the whole point of the game, is to get that ending for better or for worse.
So yeah, Ultima was extremely important in the kind of shape and design of the Japanese RPG. Yeah, Final Fantasy, Chrono Trigger with the positional combat system, the Lunar series, the Saga series, where there's all kinds of things hidden in the world and you have no idea what the hell they do.
Yeah, I know all about that.
That's so Ultima. My God. But I do want to talk about a game that helped influence Japanese RPGs in maybe a non-obvious way, and that is a graphical adventure called Portopia Renzoku Satsujin Jiken. Brian, you know what that means.
It is the Portopia serial murder case, essentially.
Okay, and this footage is not of that game, but it is of a game for SG-1000 called Loretta no Shozo Sherlock Holmes, which is very much inspired by Portopia. Portopia was another one of those games that it was just foundationally imported over there, even though no one has ever played it in the U.S. unless they went out and imported it and struggled through the Japanese text or played a fan translation. But this game was originally created, I want to say, in 1984 on Japanese home computers. It was designed by a guy I mentioned before, Yuji Horii, for the studio Enix. And a year later, you know, it was fairly popular. Enix did a lot of these kind of computer-to-console ports. A year later, Enix had Chunsoft put together the Famicom version, and that became the inflection point of a lot of things. For one thing, it was the first collaboration between Chunsoft and Yuji Horii, which would be important because the following year they would create a game called Dragon Quest. But Dragon Quest draws a lot of interface and design elements from Portopia. It's one part wizardry, one part Portopia. And it's kind of hard to talk about its impact without having played it, which I haven't. Brian, have you played it?
I have not played it.
Oh, no.
Surprisingly, it's a pretty big blind spot for me, too. But, I mean, you have Sherlock Holmes up here, which, as you mentioned, is quite influenced for it, or from it. And if you can almost close your eyes and throw a dart at a board of kind of mid to later 80s Famicom games, and there's like a pretty good chance that they'll be pretty directly influenced by Portopia if they're attempting to be an adventure game in any way. So even if you haven't played Portopia, like, there's a good chance that you might have played something that's close enough to.
I mean, if we haven't had a localization of it, but if we got Famicom Detective Club localization.
We got a localization.
Did we?
Yeah, it was on Switch.
Good warning to me. I had no idea.
It was like last year or the year before? Yeah.
Oh, okay, because I know we got the Famicom Detective Club. Maybe it just went over my head. Okay.
Yeah, they all kind of play the same.
I'll excuse myself, because obviously I know nothing.
You're working your way through the story, and it only advances when you make the right calls. Otherwise, you just sort of blockade it. Which is an interesting comparison to, you know, you look at Western text adventures or adventure games that they sort of took a different tack to the same problem, like how you tell a story but not have people go wildly off the rails. Like you mentioned Famicom Detective Club, and there's a lot of other games that sort of Portopia DNA in them, like
Phoenix Wright is a good one.
Phoenix Wright. I actually went from playing what was Famicom adventure text games to playing Phoenix Wright. I'm like, oh, this is just the same thing.
I've also noticed in the notes, and this is a huge shout out, Hotel Dusk. Now that was a great game. I love that game so much. Never played the sequel, but. I mean, that style of game had a resurgence on the DS because it was like, you know, like a little novel. It was like a book, and kind of sad it didn't stick around for as long as it should have.
There's also the Game Center CX 2 DS game has Detective Haruno.
It's true.
A really fun, old adventure game in this style.
Yeah, another thing that made Portopia so impactful at the time was that, kind of like the RPG, the adventure genre was really big on early computers, and you know, people wanted to play it here and people in Japan wanted to play it, but it was much more accessible because it was all text oriented. So if you didn't read and, you know, have the ability to parse English, then it was kind of tough to make your way through a game that pretty much just consisted of English text. And there were some early inroads made into creating Japan-centric, you know, Japan-focused adventure games. One of the first came in 1982, so the genre had been around for a while, called Omote Sando Adventure, which was basically just like an amateur program. I think you could type it in from the back of a magazine, but you were basically like finding your way around in a kind of a wizardry-inspired maze that consisted of an office complex in Omote Sando, an area of Tokyo.
Why on earth is
that's
it called
terrifying.
Omote Sando Adventure?
I think it takes place in like that neighborhood, basically.
Okay.
You have to make it to Kitty Land and buy some Hello Kitty stuff. I don't know.
Copy machine attacks coming in.
But that game was you know, people who were into that genre definitely played it and were inspired by it. At the same time, Mystery House by Sierra kind of had a big impact too, because it was the first adventure game in sort of the Zork style that had graphics. It had, you know, like very crude graphics, but it kind of showed you the home setting that you were in. And so Yuji Horii drew from those inspirations, those elements, to put together his adventure game. But his adventure game focused around a murder mystery. You were a detective, and you were traveling around the town of Portopia and trying to figure out, you know, the identity of a murderer who was behind this string of murders. And so you would go and you would talk to people, you could take items, you could use items, you could ask questions, you know, kind of all the text adventure type stuff you expect to do. But when the game came to Famicom on console, you didn't have access to a full keyboard. I mean, there was a keyboard for Famicom, but not that many people owned it, and it was cumbersome and kind of ridiculous. So instead, Chunsoft stripped it down and really simplified it to use a menu-based like cursor system where you would choose questions or commands from a menu. And it's kind of like a precursor to the Lucasfilm games Scum Engine, although I'm sure Lucasfilm didn't take inspiration directly from Portopia. But, you know, that same system became part of Dragon Quest, like the whole windowed system. And it was just a huge, huge hit and became very popular. It was during that period where if you put a game on Famicom, it was going to sell a million copies. So, you know, millions of kids played this game, and they're probably their parents, too, and were very, very influenced by it. So when you look at the graphical adventure genre in Japan versus the rest of the world, Japan tends to focus very heavily on police procedurals in a way that the West does not. And it is because of this influence, or you know, games about murder. Like, anything Goichi Suda has created, like, you can see Portopia's fingerprints all over it. Games like Danganronpa and Zero Escape, which are actually made by Spike Chunsoft, so it's kind of this, you know, everything kind of coming together. Hotel Dusk in the Last Window, Ace Attorney, Jake Hunter, you know, there was the Sherlock Holmes game,
I guess, thinking Famicom Detective Club. You can understand why Nintendo, which was like just really infamous about censorship back in the day, was probably not so hot about murder mysteries being released on their console, which is too bad. I think it's fascinating.
They made their own.
I guess so, yeah, but not for America.
No, but I think that was more of a localization concern in terms of technical concerns.
I just think it's interesting that, like, how they decided, okay, we can't use a keyboard. How do we kind of strip this down and make it into an accessible menu? And I always like hearing about how developers get around, like, those problems limited by hardware.
So anyway, lots and lots of games very heavily influenced by Portopia, and kind of an unusual inflection point for the role-playing genre, but it's there. And then finally, we're going to talk about the Tower of Draraga, which kind of defined the action RPG. Around the same time as Tower of Draraga hit arcades, 1984, we also had Dragon Slayer and Hydlide hit home computers. But the Tower of Draraga, even though it doesn't look like it, came out in arcades. It was built on Super Pac-Man hardware by the guy who created Zevies. And he was like, I want to make a role-playing game in a maze for arcades. This game is a horrible fit for arcades, but it did have this communal aspect that didn't really exist in American arcades. Ryan, is that something you or Kevin could talk about, maybe?
Yeah, we were actually talking about this yesterday, about how there used to be notebooks that you could find in the corner of a Japanese arcade. Some even had them up until about 10 or 15 years ago. I think they're a thing of the past now, but they originated around this time for people to write secrets that they found in to kind of help other people through these games.
Were these, like, official documents, or were they just things that, like, people...
Literally just a notebook.
Yeah, but, like, was it, like, official of the arcade, or was it just something, a secret that, like, was passed on from player to player and had nothing to do with the arcade itself, the proprietor of the arcade?
The arcade posted it.
Yeah.
Official, I mean, didn't say no.
Good enough.
So anyway, we don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but it was a moderate hit in arcades and then became, you know, again, because anything you sold on Famicom in 1985 was going to sell a million units, became really big on Famicom. But also, I think, you know, when you had the luxury of playing it at home and with a strategy guide, you could kind of afford to play a game that was very challenging and obtuse in a way that was difficult in arcades, where everything cost 100 yen, which is like a dollar. And you got three lives, and they can go really quickly in this game. But the Tower of Draraga is filled with just arcane secrets. Every single floor of this 60-floor tower has a secret. And there's no way for you to know how to find it until you stumble across it or someone tells you. Some of them are, you know, very simple, like kill three of these things and a treasure chest will appear. But some of them are like face the north wall and then turn away. Or like wait until there's 60 seconds or 60 points on the timer and then kill the last enemy or something. It's just, it's always different. And I think this kind of, you know, filled game developers with some bad ideas. Like things have to be obtuse and difficult and unfriendly. But, you know, the influence of this game is obvious. I mean, you can look at this and, you know, you see the wizards appearing and zapping. And you see the little slimes. You're like, well, this is Zelda. There's darkness,
the
you know?
Darkness.
Yeah,
sure.
Like, Zelda definitely took some influences from this game. But you look at things like La Mulana. Deadly Towers was one that was, you know, I wouldn't say popular on NES, but definitely
it was there.
Vexed many children.
It was present.
Look at Castlevania 2 with its the people who actually just straight up lie to you. They don't even give you hints. They just tell you the wrong thing. Mylon's Secret Castle, where you had to, like, throw whatever it was Mylon was throwing at random bricks to
even
show
thinking
things.
Thinking about, like, say, a game like Super Mario Brothers 3, where how do you find the coin ship? I can't remember the number you're supposed to end with the level on, but like you find the coin ship by finding this very specific number. You find the toad house by finding this very specific number. And that's all stuff that was also passed down by word of mouth or strategy guides.
Yeah, Nintendo definitely pulled a lot from Draraga for the Mario series, all the hidden items and whatnot. And, you know, even as new as something like From Software games,
they
pull a lot of that.
Absolutely, that communal book is Elden Ring in a nutshell.
It really is.
So we are out of time, but I do want to say if you understand these games, Breakout, Zevius, Heianchio Alien, Wizardry, Ultima 3, Portopia Renzoku, Satsujin Jiken, and the Tower of Draraga, you have a pretty good understanding of everything that you saw on the NES and Master System and TurboGrafx and Genesis for the next 10 years, maybe beyond. You know, the impact of these games is still reverberating throughout video gaming. And these are, you know, this is just kind of the foundation. It's the Bible. It's the blueprints. So check out these games if you ever have the time. I highly recommend them. And if you play the Tower of Draraga, use a game genie for infinite lives and look up a strategy guide. There's no shame in it because that's how it was designed to be played.
Absolutely.
Anyway, thank you everyone for your time and thank you panelists for your contribution.
Thank you. Thank you.
Eliminate clutter and embrace the freedom of HyperX wireless gaming gear for PC and console. Power through all the great monthly PlayStation Plus games with the Cloud Stinger Core Wireless for PlayStation. Enjoy lightweight comfort with reliable wireless freedom, so you won't miss plot points when you head to the fridge. High-quality HyperX wireless products can be found at most fine retailers, as well as online at Target, Best Buy, and Amazon. Or you can shop for them directly at HyperX.com and HP.com.
In a world with too many comic book podcasts and not enough deep dives into your favorite superheroes, one podcast stands as a shining beacon in a world of pain and darkness.
Yeah, darkness. Yeah, lots of darkness. Bunch of dark stuff. Superhero stuff you should know. That's us.
Andrew, why are you talking like that? I'm the movie voice guy now.
I'm the new movie voice guy, and it's time for you to listen to superhero stuff you should know.
So we have like unused concept art, unmade scripts, unmade superhero movies. All check us out at Superhero Stuff You Should Know.
Ben, you should do a movie voice guy voice. Guy voice.
I would, but I think we're out of time. Superhero Stuff You Should Know, part of the HyperX Podcast Network.
Part of the HyperX Podcast Network.
I just said that.
Us. We're the Spirit Hunters, and we're a show that treats Hunter Hunter and Yu Hakusho's author as the center of the universe. Some weeks we do linguistic analysis. The Chinese meaning of this character is to smelt or refine, but to the changed meaning in Japanese it means to temper. Other times, we get absolutely smashed.
So we take one shot every time. Yusuke uses the ray gun.
1 hour later.
This is the least coherent episode.
Sarah, you should... I think your pirate is hot.
Check us out at the HyperX Podcast Network.
Eliminate clutter and embrace the freedom of HyperX wireless gaming gear for PC and console. Power through all the great monthly PlayStation Plus games with the Cloud Stinger Core Wireless for PlayStation. Enjoy lightweight comfort with reliable wireless freedom, so you won't miss plot points when you head to the fridge. High-quality HyperX wireless products can be found at most fine retailers, as well as online at Target, Micro Center, Best Buy, Amazon, Walmart, or shop directly at HyperX.com and HP.com.
To the 3 p.m. panel, documenting video game history. We're going to document video gaming history. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and also here with me on this panel, we have...
I'm Kelsey Lumen. I am co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And I'm Norman Russo. I'm the creator of The Game Historian on YouTube.
Oh, I forgot my bona fides. I co-host Retronauts, a podcast. So all of us document video game history in very different ways. And so this is going to be a pretty loose, improvisational, extemporaneous kind of presentation. I think we're going to have a lot of Q&A if anyone's interested in asking questions. But to get started, I thought we could just talk a little bit about how we even got into doing this. Like, what's the inspiration behind this obsession each of us has, and just kind of go from there. So, Norm, I'm going to let you kick things off. Like, how did you become the gaming historian?
Well, I am the gaming historian. I'm the only gaming historian.
It's true. We bestow those titles on people. And,
to both of them. Yeah, I'm just kidding. I started in 2008 on YouTube. I was 20 years old, and I was getting my bachelor's degree in history. And so I loved history, and I loved video games, and I loved a show called G4 Icons. It's one of my favorite shows, and I just wanted kind of more of that kind of content. So I said, well, I'll try to make it myself. This might be fun. And that's kind of how I got started. 2008 YouTube was wildly different than what it is today.
I got started just getting interested in weird stuff. I was working in a retro game store and was seeing some games I had never really seen before, like Packy and Marlon on the Super Nintendo, which is a game about diabetes and elephants. And I was just kind of curious, like, how does stuff like this make it out there? And that kind of that got me interested in starting to research, and especially when I looked up games like that, you know, some of the more out there stuff, there weren't really people looking into that history. So it was an interest in the bizarre and the unknown and the obscure.
I actually thought Packy and Marlin was tied to Pocky and Rocky until just now.
Yes, they're elephant cousins who have diabetes, yeah.
Elephant, Tanuki, pretty much the same thing. As for myself, I kind of came at this from a different angle because I'm really old. And so I actually have lived through most of video gaming history and experienced a lot of it firsthand. Back in 1996, I think, there was this thing called the World Wide Web that people were getting really into. And so I bought this really big book of HTML coding and set up a GeoCities page for myself. And, you know, said, I'm gonna be on the internet. And I ended up kind of gravitating toward posting stuff about video games. I rediscovered NES games, which, you know, had kind of disappeared, and I saw them in a pawn shop and said, you know, I really like Metal Gear. That was so long ago. It was 7 years before. but it seemed so long. And so I just started, you know, writing about old video games, and then eventually I kind of fell into doing freelance work with sites like GameSpot and the Gaming Intelligence Agency, which I kind of was there for the launch of and contributed to for a long time. I just increasingly focused on old stuff, and then I got a job in the actual games press and realized no one in the professional games press is really taking anything that's not current very seriously. And so I kind of made that a niche for myself just because I wanted to write about games that I liked, and they just happened to be old. So in addition to, you know, reviewing stuff that no one else wanted to review, like Game Boy Advance games, I started writing about old stuff. And then when 1UP.com and all the magazines associated with it started making podcasts about their publications, all the magazines, I was like, well, I don't have a magazine, but I do like old video games. So I started a podcast about old video games, and somehow I'm still doing that 16 years later. And so everything that I do now, it just kind of revolves around old video games. Which actually kind of brings me to the next question. You're both so young. How did you... for me, writing about old video games is a lot of it's just, you know, reclaiming what it was like to be a kid in the 1980s. But you probably don't remember that.
I do not remember the 1980s.
Yeah, see?
That's correct.
I have vivid memories.
I mean, I think that's the historian part of it, right? It's like, I don't know where these came from because I wasn't there. And I found that pretty fascinating because clearly there is like an evolutionary line between where games came from and where they are now. And so in order to get to the now, you got to learn a little bit about what came before me. So it's a little different. It's rather than a nostalgia thing, it's like a, how did this happen? Where did this come from?
Yeah, what about you, Norm?
I'm more of a 90s kid, but I have an older brother, and so I felt like I was kind of handed down these older video games, and I kind of grew up on the older stuff. And I think what really got me into the more of the retro scene was I got a job at GameStop when I was in college, and people would bring in these old games and trade them in, and GameStop wouldn't take them. But I would be like, oh, I remember this, I remember playing this, yeah, I remember being my buddy playing this growing up. And so I wasn't allowed to do this, but I would buy them, like, in the parking lot from these people after hours. So that's how I really got into it, and that's kind of how I dived into more of the history stuff, too. So...
yeah, so, you know, for myself, like I said, a lot of what I write about is stuff that I was there just to witness firsthand, and, you know, writing about stuff that I owned when I was 10, 15 years old. and it still wasn't 16 bits yet, so if that, you know, puts a number on my age. But, you know, it's not just nostalgia. It is, there is more to it, and Kelsey, I really appreciate what you said about needing to understand what came before, because that was really the sort of ethos that I brought into my work in the professional games press, was that, yeah, it's cool to write about, you know, Destiny or Minecraft or, you know, any of these big games that's happening right now, but you need to really understand what came before it. And it's always interesting, you know, speaking of Minecraft, to play old video games with some of my nephews who are super into Minecraft, because they see NES 8-bit art and they're like, oh, it's just like Minecraft. And they don't mean that it's, you know, three-dimensional, that you're building stuff. They mean everything is made of, like, simple square blocks. And so, you know, there's this just this constant sort of feedback loop, I think, that feeds into video games. And that's why there is so much value in writing about video game history and kind of servicing that. But, you know, I feel like the privilege of having lived through all of this for me means that maybe I don't have the most, the tightest methodology about covering video game history. I don't have to do as much research, and it tends to be a little more off the cuff. Maybe you know, it's the same for you, and you've just absorbed knowledge over the years. But I'm curious, both of you, like, how much does research and just, like, you know, going to the internet, going to... Is LexisNexis still a thing?
It's still a thing.
Yeah.
I pay for it.
Yeah.
Oh, and newspapers.com.
Right. Yeah, newspapers.com is a big one. How much of that comprises the work that you do versus, you know, just the actual hands-on experiencing, you know, playing a video game?
Playing the game is maybe 5%.
If that.
It's not a lot. You know, people seem to think that, oh, this guy just plays video games all day. It's like, no, it's really not about the playing when you're doing the research. I mean, obviously, you play the game, and, you know, I have experienced a lot of games that I've covered. But, yeah, it's trying to get in touch with people that worked on the game. It's looking through these old newspapers. It's looking through these old press releases. It's looking at all these old magazines and how did they cover the game. Who did they talk to when the game was coming out? What was the hype surrounding this game? So it's really just kind of casting a wide net, trying to understand the context and what it was like when these things came out.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on the story you're trying to tell. But the places I tend to start are, starting to look at maybe how it was represented in the media, because that's... You'll eventually probably want to talk to developers and that sort of thing and get the development side of it, but I find that you can at least start getting a sense of, like, well, what does this game actually mean, you know, legacy-wise, based on what people thought about it in the public and maybe how that's changed over the years and... you know, did it cost more when it came out and then got a massive price cut and, you know, all kinds of things like that. So, I mean, I think it depends on the story you're trying to tell, but playing the game and even, like, remembering time I had with the game doesn't really play much of a role in it for me at all, other than maybe just inspiring me to start looking deeper into it.
So let me ask both of you, if you could, just to sort of describe the sort of work that you do, you know, the outward-facing part of it, and also what goes into actually creating that. Because I think all of us create pretty different things or work on different things. I mean, you know, a lot of what you do, Kelsey, isn't even necessarily creating. It's more like being there as sort of a middleman of information and a resource for people who are putting out publications.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a resource for this guy sometimes.
Yeah, I love nerd and prank all the time.
Yeah, I mean, what we do at the foundation in particular is we want to make people like his life a lot easier. So it shouldn't be as difficult as it is right now to research video game history. You should be able to have access to, you know, the magazines that covered it, to the developers that covered it, or the developers that worked on it, and some of the artifacts that they used in the making of it, and and you know, really just anything context surrounding the game itself. So because Norm knows where to find the game, he can play the game. But yeah, well, I mean, we're an archive, a library and archive, so a lot of what we do is really just kind of gathering that stuff and then trying to help researchers who are looking for that stuff. So sometimes that's like press releases we might have. I think we gave you that lovely fax from Konami for the Laserscope video.
Yeah, so in my LightGun video, I talked about every LightGun on the NES, and I did the Laserscope, and I was talking with Frank and Kelsey and said, oh, we got this funny fax about the Laserscope, and one of the fax, I guess Konami complained to the manufacturer that the Laserscope doesn't really work well if you're an adult and your head's a little bigger. And the manufacturer just said, well, it's not made for adults, it's made for kids. And if you have a big head like his name, Thomas Wong. Thomas Wong, it's not gonna work. It was so funny and interesting to see that communication between Konami and manufacturers about, you know, this silly little headset for an NES.
And it's, you know, it's a funny fact, but like what you actually get out of that practically is like, you know, you might have used a Laserscope and been like, this is kind of uncomfortable, and that was my lived experience with it. And it's like, well, did Konami know it was uncomfortable? And it turns out, yes, they absolutely knew it was uncomfortable, but you wouldn't know that unless, you know, you had that fax to kind of illuminate that.
Yeah. So with my stuff, I feel I'm more of a like a storyteller, I guess. But, you know, the word story is in history, so it's kind of makes sense, right? So I feel like my job is to present the history of video games in like a palatable way for a general audience, and that's kind of what I like to do. And how I do that is I try to find anything and everything about the topic and then present it in a way that anyone can enjoy it. And that includes interviewing people involved. That includes reading newspaper articles or video game magazines. I love using visuals, like really good visuals in my videos. I always bug Frank and Kelsey for these weird, obscure magazines. I'm like, do you have EGM number 12 that only covered Sega games? I think they had like a Sega a magazine.
Yeah, there was like it was either a pack-in or a spin-off thing.
Yeah, it was like a Genesis special. But I will say the digital stuff's come a long way. Like when I first started, it was there was some stuff, but now it's like, man, the Internet Archive has just grown so much with these old video game magazines and press releases and whatnot. And it's all of us, like all of you and everyone involved in video games is uploading to this and making it happen. So it's really a community effort to get all that stuff up.
Yeah, and there's still a lot to be done with all the digital information that's coming into existence. I mean, just because this, you know, resource is out there doesn't necessarily mean that we know about it or know where to look into it. So as an example of that, last year I did a video series covering the entire Sega SG-1000 console and its library, and there was very little information about any of that stuff in English that was, you know, confirmed. And even Sega themselves don't actually list hard release dates for all the games. Like, they say, this game came out in 1984. And that's it. So there's like a dozen, 20 games that just have, you know, a year as their release date. And I like to put together things chronologically to sort of tell the story of how console platforms evolve. And it's impossible to do that when even the people who created the system are like, we don't actually know. I mean, I reached out through Sega official channels. You know, someone who's really, the company is really invested in telling Sega history and getting that story out there. And he reached out to, you know, the Sega internal teams, and they were like, yeah, we can't really tell you anything about this console because no one who designed it is still at the company. Like, we just aren't able to give you that information. It doesn't exist here. So even the institutional knowledge is there. But then a few months ago, someone named the alias Tweakbot. I have no idea who that is, but the alias Tweakbot on the Gaming Alexandria Discord was digging around an old Japanese arcade industry-oriented magazine called Game Machine. And this was published, you know, throughout the 80s into the 90s. and found a couple of issues where they had actually gone through and said, well, here's what's happening on the console side of the business. And it had release dates for the Nintendo Famicom and the SD-1000 and the Epoch Cassette Vision, Super Cassette Vision. And it actually had them down by dates when those games showed up at retail. So all of a sudden, you know, here I was on my next to last of 25 videos, and this information suddenly becomes available to me that would have been amazing to have when I started the project. You know, it's great because for me, my videos that I put on YouTube, they're pretty much a rough draft. And then I take the scripts and, you know, I turn those into books like this, where I try to get all the facts straight. And, you know, anything I screw up on in a YouTube video, the commenters are going to tell me. So there's no question, like, I'm going to get the facts right eventually. I just kind of have to take my lumps with the video. But, you know, the information about release dates wasn't much help for the SD-1000 videos, but when I put together the book about that later this year, that's going to be great because I can actually recontextualize everything and say, like, well, we thought this was a launch game, but actually it shipped a year after the system came out, so now we have a better understanding of kind of where it falls into place and, you know, how these games actually came out and what the experience was of people who were invested in the system and, you know, went to the stores, went to you know, their favorite Yodobashi camera or whatever, and we're like, ah, yes, new SD-1000 release. Excellent. I can finally play Flicky at home. Like, now, you know, it just gives us a better sense of what the experience was like to have been there, you know? And it's not telling us how people actually reacted to these games, but just knowing, you know, the sort of way that things were presented and what became accessible to people is really great. But again, you know, you have to know where to find that information, and there's so much out there that's just raw and unfiltered. It's really difficult. And that's what's great about Gaming Alexandria, and what's really great about the Video Game History Foundation is, you know, there's a whole lot of that just sifting through this massive pile of information, raw information, that's being done. And, you know, that's going to be a huge, huge, just huge help for people like me and for people like Norm who are trying to tell stories and trying to kind of put a finger on things and say, you know, like, we want to understand how it was. Now we can have a better understanding of what it was. And every bit of information that comes in helps us to paint a clearer and more defined picture.
Yeah, I mean, we have a full-time librarian now at the Video Game History Foundation, which is really exciting, and is going to, I think, do a lot to start making some of that a little bit more discoverable and searchable. But I think the point to be taken from this is, like, there's still a ton of stories out there right this second that haven't actually been mined out of the sources that are floating around there. So there's, like, infinite video game history stories still to tell, and I truly believe that anyone can do it as long as you're willing to put in the work and like really get curious, really look into things.
Yeah, you are absolutely right about there are a million stories to tell. I remember when I decided I was going to do a video on the U-Force, and I just did general research first, and I remember seeing the Wikipedia article, and it was like two sentences about the U-Force. And I was like, oh man, this video is not going to be that interesting. And then I like got in touch with the guy that invented the U-Force, Dave Capper, and I found out, oh, this guy is this huge prolific inventor that invented all sorts of stuff. Like, he invented those lollipops that play music when you eat them, and he invented those, I think they're called hit clips. You know, they play like 15 seconds of a song. He invented that. He was this prolific inventor, and he was like, it was funny because I was like, I want to talk to you about the U-Force. He was like, that was the worst thing I ever invented. Like, but he was so thrilled that somebody was interested in it. And so, yeah, it's amazing that, you know, you read an article and it's two sentences about U-Force, and then I end up making a 40-minute video about it, and there was stuff I had to cut out of the video. So, like, there's just so much stuff out there that we can talk about.
Say are the biggest impediments to your work, you know, the stumbling blocks or the things that you just can't seem to overcome that, you know, are maybe systemic or just, you know, personal hang-ups or something. I don't know, like, what is it that, you know, you wish you could push past and you know, remove from your workflow?
I mean, it really all comes down to, I think, an access thing. There's not a lot out there that is A, surviving necessarily. I mean, a lot of developers didn't really keep their old stuff. If there was any documentation, like if they actually took the time to make a design document or something along those lines, they probably didn't keep it. And in a lot of cases, especially in the early days, they weren't really there might not have been like a real good system in place for like, we're going to first make this design document and then we're going to make this document and everything's going to be sorted really well. So there's not always a good amount of that out there for anything. And then, I mean, you've mentioned this a little bit, but it's like you kind of have to start talking to people to really get the stories. And sometimes it also unearths the actual documents and the actual artifacts and just information and stuff that isn't straight from their mouths. I mean, I've gotten photos from people, photos and videos, and in really rare cases, like source code, even that's like the real meat of learning about what goes on under the game's hood, and you can learn some really interesting things about maybe why decisions were made and that sort of thing if you have access to that. But there's not a lot of it floating around out there, and it's a vanishingly small amount that we're kind of desperately trying to grab at. So that's the reason I got involved in the foundation in the first place, is I was just a very frustrated historian. I was doing some YouTube videos basically in the same vein as Norm for a while, and I think the part that really broke me was I was working on a video about the Super Nintendo Extertainment Bike, which is an exercise bike that hooks up to your Super Nintendo. And I was having to mine from like several different newspapers and random, consumer magazines and that sort of thing. Just there would be like a one or two sentence thing, and they all clearly came from a press release, but they were all taking different parts of the press release. And so I was like capturing all of the, like, it's like someone tore up a map and just like scattered them to the winds. And so I had to piece this all together, and I did. And it took a really long time, like several, probably more than 10 hours of research, and just on trying to piece together this press release. And later on, when the Video Game History Foundation was helping out at Game Informer magazine, they kind of have like a room that they were just throwing all of the press releases and other stuff they were sent into, and we went there to go digitize a ton of it. And in there, I came across the press release for the Extertainment Bike, and just line by line was each one of these. I was like, I found that in this newspaper. I found that line over here. And it was like, I could have saved myself like 15 hours if I just had this press release to begin with. And that was kind of the moment that broke me. I was like, why don't we have access to this stuff?
Sometimes I'll find like an article in a newspaper, and then I'll click on another result, and it's like that same article, but they added like two more sentences that I thought, well, those seem pretty important. Why weren't they in the other article? Yeah, you find a lot of duplicates. If I could read Japanese, my job would be a lot easier. That would be really
good.
Luckily, I have some friends that know Japanese, and they're very, very kind and helpful to me. So, I'll send them stuff, and they'll say, oh, this is nothing, this is not important, you want to worry about this. Or they'll say, oh, this is really interesting, yes, I will translate this. That would definitely help my stuff.
Yeah, I feel like my biggest impediment to my work is me. Mainly, I spend a lot of time working at the games press, doing a lot of different roles, including reviewing. And I kind of feel like anytime you spend a lot of your energy and your career reviewing games, there's this just kind of antagonistic relationship that builds up with the community and with developers. So I'm always very shy about reaching out to developers, because I think, well, what if I reviewed a game by them and I gave it a bad score, and now they think that I'm the worst?
They've got your name written on the wall, probably, just waiting for you.
You'd be surprised. Some developers have very long memories. Most developers, though, are actually actually pretty cool. They're like, yeah, okay, that's fine. That wasn't the greatest game. But I always try not to be like super mean about stuff. But, you know, it was much easier when I was working in the press and I could reach out to contacts like in Japan and say, hey, you know so-and-so and so-and-so. Can you, you know, set us up an interview with them? And they were always happy to, you know, say, yeah, we'll go ahead and do that for you and translate for us. And, you know, I was able to reach out to a lot of very esoteric and forgotten people, you know, at least in the West, who played important roles and made interesting video games, you know, during the 8 and 16-bit eras in Japan. And that's not so easy to do now between COVID, you know, locking down travel and just, you know, my having moved on to a different part of my career. So I'm really trying to train myself to be more active about reaching out to people. But, you know, again, I do have, I guess, kind of the privilege of having just been around a really long time and just absorbed. Like, I can't remember, you know, people's faces if I haven't met them 3 or 4 times, but I can remember a lot of really minute details about video games. And I don't know what that says about me, but it's very helpful for my work. And so, you know, that's, I guess you take the good with the bad.
Can I add on to this, actually?
Yeah, please.
So when you were saying that you're your own worst enemy sometimes, I definitely feel that because Kelsey and I have talked about this before, where you publish something, and then a week later, someone finds something else about the same time. You're like, ah, great, my stuff's outdated already. You know, so but you have to understand that history is always changing, that it's always improving. We're always learning more and more about the past. And if anyone out there is wanting to make videos, my best advice is don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Like, get it out there.
The research is quite literally never actually done, but you do have to end it at some point.
Yeah. I remember watching a documentary. It was like the making of South Park. I think it's called like 6 Days to Air or something. And Trey Parker, one of my favorite lines from that was, you know, they make a South Park episode weekly. They have 1 week to make a South Park episode. And he talked about, well, you know, I can sit with this episode and work on it for months. But in the end, it's probably only going to be like 5% better. And so that really resonated with me. That like, yeah, you can't just sit on something forever and work on it. You got to get it out there.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I am glad to be able to do, you know, work in print, because it does a chance to revisit things and say, well, I got this wrong, or, you know, I missed this, or what often happens, as you say, like new research comes up, you know, like pretty recently I sent my Virtual Boy history book back for reprints and I had to add something to it, or I chose to add something to it, because one of the games in there, the very notorious Virtual Lab, which is just one of the worst games you'll ever play. Bad Game Hall of Fame, a website called Bad Game Hall of Fame, the proprietor reached out and managed to get in touch with the person responsible for creating that game and did a really great interview that offered a lot of insight. And a lot of that insight was basically things that, you know, I had speculated in my book, like this was probably put together in almost no time by someone who had never worked on this hardware, trying to get it rushed out the door before the manufacturing closed on Virtual Boy. And that was absolutely correct. But then there were some things that, you know, some unkind assumptions I made that turned out not to be true. So, you know, added a little errata, you know, like an addendum basically to the next revision of the book, just to kind of, you know, clear the air, not to say like, oh, I got it right, but also like, oh, I got it wrong. And, you know, it's always great to have that opportunity. You know, if I had more time, I would love to just create videos that follow up on previous videos and say like, hey, here's a catch-all for all the stuff that I got wrong. And I kind of did that with SG-1000, actually, once I finished the library. I was like, well, hey, you saw my introductory video a year ago. Now here's what we actually know, and here's all the stuff that I goofed up on and got wrong. And, you know, I think it's helpful to be able to admit that you're not perfect and to be able to publicly say, like, you know, I didn't get everything right and here's where I messed up. I think having that element of humility goes a long way towards strengthening your work rather than being a sign of weakness. And I think I think it helps audiences understand, like, hey, you're just human too, and that, you know, it opens up an opportunity for everyone who watches your work or reads your work to kind of become a participant in it and be able to say, like, hey, here's some information that you missed or that you got wrong. And, you know, it just is kind of a collective effort, really, in a sense. Minutes left. So, do you guys want to say anything more, or should we open up to Q&A for the audience?
If anyone has any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
I have a question over here. Jeremy, how do you approach covering games and chronological type of content that may not seem to be very interesting or good? How do you find something to pull out of that to make someone interested in that item?
I don't know, actually. I just start writing, and, you know, I'm always trying to contextualize things. Not only, you know, like, this is what this game is, but also this is where this game happened in time, and here's the people who created this game, and here's how it compares to what's come before. So I feel like when you just look at all those different elements, there's always a story to tell about a game, even if it is, like, the 23rd Famicom baseball game. Like, honestly, I can't stand sports video games, but I always feel like my sports-focused episodes are really, really good. And maybe it's because I'm so disinterested, I'm desperate to find something to say. But, like, I put together a Bases Loaded episode about, you know, the NES game a few months ago, and I'm like, man, I wish all my work was this good. I wish I also liked this game, but it's just, you know... I think you just have to cast around and say, what is this game's story? Even if the story is that there is no story to it, there's something to say. You know, it varies from game to game. Yeah.
So for Norman, for Jeremy, what's like a dream project that you'd like to cover that you haven't had the chance or the opportunity to cover? Because for Kelsey, like, what is something you'd like to have the time to research or have the time to look into?
You don't have a go-to answer on this? I never do.
No.
Something I'm, like, very fascinated by that I don't suspect we'll ever really see much of surface ever is a game project at Nintendo called Cabbage, which was, there've never been any screenshots, there've never been any, you know, anything other than just a couple little blurbs, but from what it sounds like, from what it seemed like they, you know, the concept they were kind of playing with, it was primordial soup of things that turned into, like, Animal Crossing and Nintendogs and even, like, the Miis a little bit. Like, it's just kind of all of these concepts that went on to eventually be used in other Nintendo projects, and I think it would be really cool to have a better understanding of where that originated. And I don't really suspect that we're ever going, like, Nintendo's not going to throw open their doors one of these days and just be like, come look at everything in the archive here. But, you know, I'm hoping that someday maybe someone at Nintendo wants to just step forward and at least provide some context to that part of the story. I mean, we need an Iwata Asks again, am I right, guys? Like, that was so good. That is so important that
happened. It was an amazing piece of
work. Yeah.
I sourced Iwata Asks a lot. Oh, is it my turn?
Yeah, dream project. Come on.
I don't know. I have stuff in my backlog that I still need to get out there. Almost 3 years ago now. I drove up to Minnesota and I interviewed the guys that created the Oregon Trail. And I wanted to do a big video about the Oregon Trail. What's interesting about the Oregon Trail is I think most of us remember the Apple II version with as the visuals, and you're going across, you know, the western United States. But I mean, there's a whole different version of that game before that one. And so I think most people are familiar with the visual one, but they're also familiar with the people that created the original text version. But then a whole other guy made the visual version. So I talked to him, I talked to the guys that made the text version. I would love to get that out someday, but...
By text version, it's like teletype.
Yeah.
Like, there's no screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's like you travel 30 miles today, and then you would just type, like, keep going, or, you know, it says, oh, it started raining, you're delayed in a day, and then you just put like, your next command. Yeah, it was very basic. I mean, he wrote it in, like, 2 weeks, so, you know. But yeah, I would love to finish that one day. There's always stuff in the backlog.
You've given people something to bug you about. Why would you do this to yourself?
I'm in grad school right now for public history, and I was like, maybe I should sit on this and make this my like graduate thesis thing.
Smart.
It's kind of what I'm planning to do with it, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't really have a single like holy grail that I would go after, but what I really love is to be able to spend like 4 months with an interpreter just in Japan, going to as many developers as I could possibly find, and like embed myself at a ghost studio like Tosei for a week just to see what it's like there, and like to look at their glass showcase of all the games they've secretly worked on to say, oh, now I understand, like, you know, this is the lodestone. But yeah, just having that kind of access to people who worked on games a long time ago. I find that in Japan, especially, people who worked on games in the 80s, like, are always amazed when someone from overseas comes and wants to talk to them about it. They're like, why do you care about this thing that I did? This was so long ago, and it was just, you know, like, a thing that I did. Who cares? But you start talking to them, and all kinds of interesting things came out. Like, I've had so many interviews where I go and I want to talk to someone about one thing, but just because I did a little research and kind of knew some of the other stuff that was tangentially related, I would mention that. And then all of a sudden the floodgates would open and they were like, oh, well, this is the thing that I really loved. Like, you know, talking to the composer of Castlevania 3 about the music, I mentioned, you know, the special chip that was in the Japanese version of Castlevania 3. And then he just like lit up and started like drawing diagrams of how the sawtooth waves worked and all the new sound channels. And he just got super, super into it. And, you know, that was a feast for me. I'd eaten off of that for years, and it was just totally incidental to what I was doing. So yeah, that's what I would love, is just to have those opportunities laid out ahead of me and not have any other commitments to worry about, just to focus on that. That would be amazing. So much research could be done. It's just so many anecdotes and so much information. But, you know, it's a lot to ask.
I'm going to give anyone who wants to do this research a quick interview tip, a couple of quick interview tips, because they're ones that have been really helpful to me. And you mentioned he kind of like lit up and started, you know, it really started like making his memory work in new ways and get re-engaged in it. The two things that I've learned: ask them to draw the layout of their office and ask them where they used to eat lunch. It just kind of sets them back in that, like, it puts them back in this, in the time that they were working on that stuff. It's like, I don't know, something kind of magic about it. I love it.
We have another question over here.
So at the beginning of your presentation, you were talking about using the Wayback Machine as a point of research. Do you find you're able to find a lot of lost video content from defunct websites like the old G4TV and game trailers?
Media is harder. Media doesn't do quite as well on the Wayback Machine necessarily than like text does.
They're okay with images, but like video...
It really depends on where the images came from.
Yeah.
Like, it depends on how far back you're going to.
Yeah, but, video, I've really never gotten anything with video, but images sometimes will pop up.
Yeah, the Wayback Machine is an incredible, incredible resource, but it's not perfect because image hosting stuff goes away and, you know, links get broken, and it's a very good sort of messy thing that we all rely heavily on.
Yeah, even for sites like IGN, they tend to have images and media hosted on separate servers from the content. So, you know, once those servers go away, you may be able to pull up the page, but it's just going to give you a broken image.
Right. And, I mean, you worked at 1UP. 1UP.com is horrible on the Wayback Machine.
Yeah, that doesn't work a lot.
It mostly doesn't work.
And I tell you about 2 years of my career loss.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. If you go back and try to read, like, a review from it, you might be able to get to the front page of the review that was broken up into 4 pages so that you would keep clicking. So, yeah, it's very bad.
All right, we've got 5 minutes, so is there another question? The guy in the PlayStation shirt?
Question for all of you. If you're just releasing a really cool piece of research, and as a result of that, somebody came forward and didn't know it was an authority, threw some new piece of information that might blew up your conclusion or something like that, would your reaction be closer to, like, oh my god, I did all this work, this guy blew it up, or... wow, this is amazing. Like, now, because there's now we know the truth, and I can, this is great.
Well, 2 things can be true.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably how that would feel.
Yeah, I've had a couple. I mean, I'm sitting on one thing right now where, like, some new stuff has come up, and it doesn't really invalidate the earlier stuff, but it's like there is more to the story that I would like to add on to, and that's a good and a bad thing. I'm glad that the story can continue, but I'm also like, I have to do more work now.
Yeah, for me, I'm always happy to see more information come out and more factual, accurate information come out, but also... usually it comes out right after I've published something. I'm like, oh, it's not like I have more work to do. Instead, why couldn't this have been like 2 weeks ago? That would have been great. So let's do one more question and then call a wrap.
So I keep seeing this quote going around from Miyamoto where, you know, there's a bad video game is bad. So, what do we do, or do you have any anecdotes about proliferation of misinformation? False history.
So I used to get really, like, kind of upset about this, about just the amount of bad information that was out there. There's the one that I always used as an example that upset me was the Gunpei Yokoi, the inventor of the Game Boy and Game & Watch, among many other things, you know, Nintendo luminary, was that he was hired as a janitor. And he worked his way up from janitor at Nintendo all the way to the head of the R&D one department.
I forgot that story.
Yeah.
Yes.
So Gunpei Yokoi went to electrical engineering college, and he was an electrical engineer. He was hired to maintain their equipment. You know, that's something that bothered me a lot. But, I mean, especially as I've kind of gotten to work with the Video Game History Foundation, I think that it's really hard to get good information. Like, there's not great sources out there. And so are people bad game historians sometimes? But yes, but it's not their fault. You know, like, it's hard to get really good sources and to get really good accurate information. I mean, the best thing you can do is really just try to debunk things and share it. And I mean, we're not going to be able to just stamp out misinformation in the world. I think we can all agree to that, but you know, we can certainly do our part in laying out how we came to those conclusions and finding them. I don't know if you guys have any ideas on how to not, how to make things that are not true go away. I don't think that, I don't know how possible that is.
I don't think you can, and I think really the best thing to do is to take a delicate touch, because if you go out swinging and just say, like, you're all wrong, why are you so stupid? This is bad information. That's not gonna win any hearts. So really the best thing you can do is just put the correct information out there and reinforce it, and just make sure that you know, the actual facts proliferate. And that's really, I don't know what you can do against misinformation besides just propagate information.
Yeah, and history, my favorite definition of history is the memory of things said and done in the past. And so even people that were involved in these things we want to talk about, memory is a thing. Maybe they don't remember it that well. Maybe they're misremembering. And so that's a big part of it, too. You can't just take people at their word sometimes.
Get more than one source.
Yeah, maybe they don't remember it that well. I mean, in one video I did, I talked about the origin of Mario character names. And I think Miyamoto has said for 30 years that he came up with the name Donkey Kong. And, you know, I he's repeated this over and over, and I don't know if it's just easy for him to say that. It makes things easier for him, but, like, you go to the court records of the Donkey Kong Universal lawsuit, and there's depositions where Miyamoto was like, I had nothing to do with it. So, you know, it's sometimes it's a memory thing.
Or maybe he just lied under oath.
Probably. Yeah,
All right, and with us disparaging one of the greatest video game creators of all time, I think that is a wrap for this panel. So thanks, everyone, for your time.
Thank you.